Hi, I'm Kate Hudson.
And my name is Oliver Hudson.
We wanted to do something that highlighted our relationship.
And what it's like to be siblings.
We are a sibling rivalry.
No, no.
Sibling rivalry.
Don't do that with your mouth.
Sibling rivalry.
That's good.
So today's episode's really interesting. We recorded this back in June. My friend Kristen, she connected us with two guys, two men, Bishop Omar and Ryan Tillman.
They call themselves brothers from another mother.
Yeah, they had, I know we got into that too. They're like, it's how the episode starts is how they met and their sort of spiritual connection. This is a really interesting episode.
Yeah, well, Ryan Tillman, okay, by the way, who I've kept in touch with, I'm actually doing his podcast in a few days. He is a police officer here in California, and he also started something called Breaking Barriers United, which invests in youth by going into neighborhoods and implementing relationship building and mentoring programs to ultimately improve police community relations and increase transparency. He's just an amazing, I guess I can call him a kid because I'm 43 years old. He's just got a bright light around him. I really, really love what he is doing. Really love what he's doing.
Yeah, and he has got just great energy, and every intention that he has moving forward is just good. And Omar, Bishop Omar, I just was like, he was so beautiful. And the work that he's done in his career, I mean, he's devoted everything to, you know, trying to curb gang violence. Mm-hmm. Travels around the world, and it's like he's a mediator. He resolves conflict, and he works with.
Yeah, he's been doing it for a while. He did with the Bloods and the Crips. He was the guy who created the first truce between the Bloods and the Crips. You know, so he has been bringing people together for a long, long time.
Yeah, Bishop Omar and Ryan was about to fly to Dallas because they were doing this summit. They had this big panel talking about everything that's going on in the world right now and things that they can do to open the dialogue and honestly make things better. But it was interesting. We got into some really interesting conversations. And
yeah, Bishop Omar, he's focused right now on this Heal America tour, which is, it's a course correction conversation on race, citizenship, and humanity. And I think just overall, we had a really open conversation with these guys about what's going on in the country right now, police brutality, their personal experiences being Black men dealing with the police.
And then how these types of conversations can help create change and more. And I think it's important to say, too, that Ryan Tillman is an active officer. So he's really trying to internally shift the culture and talk about it, have a real, be transparent, have open dialogues about it. So this was awesome. And we got right to talking about the spiritual connection that brought them together. And so I hope you guys enjoy this episode of Brothers from Another Mother. How did you guys meet?
Through Kristen and through Journey 8, Kristen and I got to talk, and she was like, oh, you have to meet Bishop Omar. So then me and Bishop Omar did an interview together on Journey 8, which was really, really cool, actually. So then I found out Bishop Omar is like my big brother from another mother. and then that's kind of how it came to be.
To be honest, man, just my feeling, it was spirit-led because it was such a natural connection.
When you guys first started talking with each other on this, what do you think brought you together?
I would probably say it's more of like with the climate we're living in, you know, there's a connection that me and Bishop Omar have, which without us even realizing was a spiritual connection, this deep spiritual connection, and the desire and passion to change what's going on for the better, you know, whether it's race, whether it's policing. I just so happen to bring up policing aspect because I'm a current day police officer. I got to work today, actually. And so, but Bishop Omar just doing all the, in, you know, the work he's doing with gangs and just bringing unity to people. I think that's kind of how our conversation got centered. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Bishop.
No, man. I mean, it was that. I think it was what you just described. And when you are looking for truth and looking for people who are truth tellers, it feels natural when you run into them. You just know that it's true. You know it's natural. You don't have to keep venting it because, see, this is a moment where everybody's getting purified. Your ideas, your thoughts, you know, everyone is putting a lens on you, a hot lens on you. So it's easy to see the truth when you see it. So when I was listening to that rhyme, I was just stunned at his vulnerability. I said that, and I was like, hey, man, he was saying, I'm willing to be vulnerable as a police officer, taking off my shields and all of that. Because I don't get that. I don't get that a whole lot. Most people are trying to hide, but he was not. And so when I'm running into people that's like that, you know, when I'm running into mm-hmm. people that's like that, it's just such a natural connection. You don't have to do nothing. Say, okay, finally, we're meeting somebody else. So whatever the reason we are meeting, I'm okay with it. I'm open to it.
Well, Ryan, where does that vulnerability come from? Like, where? How did that manifest itself?
You know, honestly, that vulnerability comes from, like, so I had no aspirations of being a police officer, like, at all. Like, I grew up, couldn't stand police officers. I felt like they, you know, if you're a police officer, you became one because you got picked on in high school. And so you're like, man, I'm about to pick on everybody else. So I'm about to become a police officer. Like, I had some bad experiences with them because I was either harassed, my family was harassed. And so, like, when it came time, you fast forward in my life, my wife got pregnant with our first son. And, you know, I was like, what am I going to do? Like, I don't know as far as what I want to do in life. I was selling insurance at the time. And so, you know, my dad's friend was like, you should become a police officer. And I was like, no, I'm not working for the man. I'm not about to be a pig. Like, that was my mentality. But then I was like, you know, let me pray about it. So I prayed about it. And I said, God, like, if this is what you want me to do, then open the door, if not close the door. Well, the doors kind of flew open and I wasn't ready for that door to fly open yet. I was like, oh, shoot, I don't know if I want this. And then finally, when I end up becoming a police officer, I was like, okay, God, like, I see you open the door for me, but, you know, why is it that you open the door here? This is something I least expected. And then that's when I saw, like, you know what, God telling me, like, hey, I want you to be better than the officers that mistreated you. I want you to be better than the officers that mistreated our family. I want you to go out there and be vulnerable with the people of the community and realize that, you know, yes, you have a job to protect and serve. But I want you to realize that the servanthood becomes before anything. You know, you have to die to yourself every single day. And so part of that is me realizing that leading with empathy, I always tell all my guys, like, lead with empathy and lead with respect. You know, if you lead with those two things and lead with love, those three things, you know, you'll never find yourself in a crazy situation. And even if you do, people will be able to see your heart. And so my dad always said it best. He's like, Ryan, treat everybody like they're your mom, your dad, your sister, your brother, your cousins. And so I take that same analogy and use that in my day-to-day job as a human being. And I think that's kind of where my transparency comes from, is like just recognizing that we're all humans, we're all in this together. I just got a job to do. Like last night, I took somebody to jail last night for selling drugs. And this guy was, he's probably in his like late 50s, early 60s, and he's still using drugs. And it was like, I told my partner, I was like, man, this was like probably, I love every time I arrest somebody that's a cool person. Like, the whole way down to the jail, I'm like playing music. I'm like playing old school music. I'm like, man, what you know about this? And he's like, he's an African-American dude. He's like, man, what do you know about this? And I'm like, man, I know more about this than you do. And so we're going back and forth. But then at the end of the conversation, when I had to go book him in, I was like, hey, man, I'm going to pray for you. He was like, you mind if I do that? He was like, man, not at all. So I prayed for this dude. And he was like, Ryan, man, I'm going to come see you when I get. He was like, I think I'm done with this, man. I was like, yeah, man, like, why be paranoid? And so I just realized, man, we have to be vulnerable. We have to be transparent with one another and recognize that we all are going through, you know, issues, but we got to go through them together.
Mm. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And Bishop, you saw that. I mean, that's an incredible way to sort of approach what you do, given the perception of what policing is, especially right now. You know, how do you get that to infiltrate the entire force? You know what I mean? Like, how do we get someone like you with your attitude and with the way that you want to go about things, leading with love, which is just an amazing, you know, way to think. How do you do that though? You know, it seems big. Problem seems really big.
It is, but for every problem, there's a solution. And so like before I became a police officer, I had aspirations of going into business. And so what I realized is when God put me in this position as a police officer, not only did he expose to me the things that needed to be changed, but he also exposed to me like, hey, I'm still going to allow you to go into business for yourself, but I'm going to have you go into business where I want you to be directed. And so I started this business, Breaking Barriers United, and I'm actually currently in the process of creating a recruiting platform that is going to be specifically geared towards finding the best quality candidates to infiltrate the system from within, as opposed to trying to make the changes from outside of it. And so, you know, we're constantly out there trying to identify good qualified candidates, you know, and that could be a cumulative of the things. It's not just say, you know, it's not to say like, hey, you know, you need a college degree, because there's some people that have college degrees that don't make good cops, you know, but there are some educated people that make great cops. And so, you know, I'm dedicated through my business to try to figure out how we can go out there. And it takes somebody that leads with love and leads with respect and leads with empathy to identify others that can do the same thing. And so I'm out there personally looking for more me's. And I'm not saying that in a confident or a cocky way, but it's just a mere fact of I want somebody to go out there and kind of have that same mindset that I do when they're dealing with people.
Mm. Amazing. Bishop Omar, you've spent 27 years working in violence intervention and including gang intervention. You've traveled the world to help resolve conflict. How did you get into this work?
Well, you know, my family, of course, has been involved in that kind of lifestyle. My father, who has been a pastor for many years, his history prior was that of intrigues, and then my other family members, tangential cousins, you know, all of that. And I was the young guy who was coming up. And so I always was aware and surrounded by the idea, but it was almost like, but we want you to be different. So I was always trying to figure out how I could have that space. But about 26, 27 years ago, I started volunteering at a youth prison, and I would work with the gangs in the youth prison. And my role was to find a way that the gangs in the prison could coexist without trying to harm each other. Because if I shot at you and I missed, and you shot at me and you missed, and we both gonna be in the prison for the next 5 years, how are we gonna coexist and live civil and then get out? Because in order to stay in the prison, you got to respect the gang. You got to represent your gang. But in order to get out, you got to denounce it. So it's almost like these young people was living in schizophrenia. But I was just called to do this. This is what I do. It's not, I didn't know that I had this gift. But when I started meeting with these gang leaders, it became apparent that that was what I was supposed to do. And then when I found that they were the key, not one key, they were the key in changing the culture, that these guys, that they had an innate ability to transform environments and societies. And so what I began to do was to take those guys from those prisons, because then I started working with the young adult prisons and the adult prisons. And so I worked with all kinds of gangs, and I would take those guys, furlough them back to their neighborhoods, and ask them to be my representatives as I talked to young folks about violence, because my goal was, urban culture should not have a violent tendency because it's poverty and because it's whatever. We should not live as violence is our natural language. And so that is what propelled me to do what I do. So I started companies. I got visionary generation urban specialists. I have something now called OGU, which I train OGs for 21 days. And then I relaunch them back. So I just do it. It's just kind of naturally what I'm drawn to. And now we're doing this deal called Heal America, which is responding to George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, responding to this racial climate and this violent climate. How do we keep it honest, but bring in a concentrated version of greater ideas through spirit and through example? So I just do it, you know, and it's kind of like natural to me. It's funny. I can remember going into places where no one spoke English, and I'm sitting up talking, and when I got home, I said, "Boy, I should have been nervous." But my brain was like, until I got home and said, "What was happening?"
Well, what does it take though? You know, because when you have two factions, you've got the Bloods and the Crips. You have two gangs who just inherently hate each other for you know, territorial reasons, for drug reasons, you know, street reasons. What is it in the human spirit that you have to sort of find in each of them to connect So then they can sort of understand, wait a minute, what are we doing here? We can actually come together and be civil and non-violent.
Yeah, how do you create that space?
Yeah.
That's the secret sauce.
The secret sauce. You know what? And that's what we call it. In our OG training, really, we say, y'all want to know the secret sauce. Nah. That's what we do. So Oliver is an OG. He don't even know he's an OG.
Hey, I'll take it. I mean, I've known that. I just haven't wanted to say anything, though.
I can tell, Oliver. I got you.
Yeah, man. So here's the deal. What we tell them, man, like I do this deal called a box. And in the box, I say, what do you hate? What do you love? What do you fear? What do you need? And I put you inside that box. And I help them understand who they are. And I say, now I'm going to create this box for you, your true identity. But the only way they will allow me to put them in a box is I have to understand their world. So I'm going to tell you, man, one time I met with some Bloods. It was about 40 Bloods in the pool hall. And I asked the Bloods, I said, how many of y'all have baby mama trouble? Everybody raised their hand. I said, how many of y'all broke right now? They raised their hands. How many of y'all dealing with the law? I said, well, let me do an anecdotal diagnosis. What you doing ain't working. it's not scientific. I ain't got no protocol. I tell them, look, man, if you give me a shot, I bet I can give you a better outcome than you have. Because there are people getting paid studying you like you Bigfoot, like you the Loch Ness Monster, like you Godzilla, and you getting shot being you. You have a market advantage, but you don't understand your marketability because the only thing you see is death. And then I would ask them questions like, what if you don't die? What if you live? What if 27 is not like 21? So you got to ask those questions because you're right. The human spirit wants to go to self-actualization, but it starts at survival. And so when you're in survival mode, your mind says, I can suspend all the rules. But once you get out of survival and start saying, this pattern is no longer survival, it is how I'm living, then someone has to explain to you what life is like. And then another thing with the gangs, I would explain to them their gangs. I would tell them what set they came from and why is it, I would go through all of this historical data on the gangs because I learned it, I embraced it. And most of them didn't even understand the gang. So I'm saying you're willing to die for what you don't understand, but won't live for the family that you say you love. That's something's wrong. So let me help you reorganize. We would tell them get them to zero. Like Charles Manson is like a -9, Jeffrey Dahmer, -9. Most people are -2, -3, and they're trying to get to zero. And at zero, you can actively be a part of your own decision making. So that's my role. I get them to zero, and then the human spirit takes over. Then your spirituality takes over. Then your examples take over, and you become this new creature.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh. That's amazing. I love that box analogy. I think that's great. But then there's a family aspect to it though. So it's in a sense you're almost tearing someone away from their family as far as the gang goes, right? There's an identity with the group, and so there's another aspect to it of trying to tear them away from something.
Remember what I was saying? I took the OGs back and I furloughed them because we were going to meet with real OGs. See, you are right. That's very good perception. So you got to meet with those who they see as family and say, I'm trying to lift a family member. Who would want to deny me an opportunity to give him a shot to, or her a shot to really be at their best self? And we are not trying to infiltrate any of your norms. We're trying to create a new normal for him because he has a daughter. Or she has a son, or they got a grandmother that's sick, or they got potential. So are you saying that we should deny this person on some oath that most of us don't really believe anyway? So you got to have OG conversations. It's real. And as long as you appear and what you are saying, they will allow you the freedom of growth. But see, it's when you're not pure about it. It's when you're using it as a cover scheme, or that's when people get nervous about you. But when it's really honest and it is what it is, like I said, when I met Ryan, my brain said he's the truth. So I released my inhibitions about what's his motive. See, I'm not trying to check his heart. I'm checking his fruit. See, I can't check your heart. I check your fruit. What are you producing? And then if your fruit is producing, your heart going to be purified because it's going to be too close to the fire. So you can't fake something that you're not, man, in your natural environment. Mm-hmm. It's going to reveal who you really are.
And so how did you guys then link up in that, okay, wait, we have a relationship here. There's something here. There's something bubbling. How did you manifest that relationship to move forward to do good?
Let me say, I'm going to let Ryan talk on this, but man, so I told you we're having this big event on the 24th. I mean, I got Mark Cuban, WWE folks. I got everybody, man. McMahon. I got them all, man, in one place. And I said to Kristen and to Ryan, when I saw his spirit, I said, every platform that I am afforded, I need that spirit to be a part of that. Because the more light you get, it drives out darkness. See, it's really simple for me. When I see light, I'm trying to expose that light to dark places, places where folks are afraid to go into those crevices. When you turn the light on, it just becomes real. So it was very, this was not hard for me. When I heard him in my spirit, affirmed it, and then I saw his work, I said, my job is to say, what platform can I give him so that his light can shine?
You know, I've been doing the work that I've been doing for about, since I became a police officer, which was almost 7 years ago. And when I started that, I've been traveling across the country, speaking at schools, speaking at colleges, speaking to police departments, trying to change this narrative. And it wasn't until George Floyd that got killed that, you know, it's almost, I refer to like the commercial of a vacuum cleaner. Like, nobody's paying attention to a commercial of a vacuum cleaner until they actually need a vacuum cleaner. And that's kind of what happened with this whole George Floyd thing, is that when it actually happened, people kind of realized and recognized the work that I had been doing. And so a lot of people came to me. But the reason I bring it up is because we talk about doors opening. Bishop Omar said something right now that it's been a story of my life for the last 3 or 4 weeks, is I've met some really key people that actually essentially got me to you guys today. God has just been working and saying, hey, look, okay, now is the time to spread this message out further. And so, you know, everybody that I've been meeting recently, you know, everybody's just had this genuine spirit. Bishop Omar said, you know, I'm very close knit, just because I don't know what a person's intentions are. But recently, like, God's been putting in my life some people that I can just see, like, have genuine intentions that want to change the way we see things.
I'm curious because, you know, this all of this intention is so beautiful. And I always go to solution. When you're solution oriented, like, how do you actually implement what it is you're trying to shift and change?
So for me, there's a few things. So kind of just going down the list. So it all started with me speaking in schools and churches, actually. I do this thing called the Initiative Workshop, where I come to your organization and I come tell my story about who I am, you know, why, you know, where I come from, the bad experiences I had. I ask you, like, have you ever had a bad experience? And then you'll tell me, yes, this is what my bad experience was. And then that leads into me going into why I got into police work, the training that I received as a police officer. And then in front of all your friends, then we transition into putting you through scenarios as a police officer that we deal with on a daily day basis. And that part is the funniest part, because now I get to play bad guy, you have to play police officer, and then I can just have fun with it. But this, it's a learning curve, and we do about 5 or 6 different scenarios, and we bring it back to, okay, now that you guys know the human side of Ryan Tillman, let's talk about the police officer side of Ryan Tillman that I deal with day to day. So I do that presentation, which kind of led me into doing motivational speaking, diversity workshops, talking about, you know, how this break in racism in our country and where it comes from, where it stems from, how do we change that? So that all happened, and then as we started doing that, you know, I recognized that people needed to hear this conversation more. People wanted to hear this conversation more. So that's when I started a podcast about 2 years ago, called the It's Needed Podcast. And where that name came from is every time I told somebody what I did, they're like, oh my goodness, that's so needed. So I created this podcast called It's Needed with my buddy named AJ. He's a police officer in Ohio. His Instagram is, oh no, it's the Popo. And so we created this podcast, and he's a phenomenal human being. I love that. He's another one of my brothers. And that podcast really just expanded, like, really, really quickly. And so that from there, we held a conference locally, which invited out all the public figures of the community. So your chiefs, your mayors, your city managers, your teachers, your students. And then ultimately, that's all led to this bigger, this grand scheme plan, which is what I've been working on. It's like my baby is this recruiting aspect, is infiltrating the system from within. So I'm all about police reform. You know what I mean? I think people get afraid of the word police reform because, or officers get afraid because they get this mindset of, oh, they're trying to tear down policing. They're trying to take it away from us. No, that's not it at all. We're just trying to find ways to do things better. So I'm all about it. So for me, I'm like, well, what's the best way to change policing? Well, it's by hiring better police officers, you know, qualified police officers, diversified police officers that look like the communities that they're policing. That's what I've been working on in the totality of things. So I say all that to say is like, I'm very solution based. Like, we can talk about problems for days, but at the end of the day, what's the solution?
Right.
And so for me, I'm very active and very intentional about the solutions that I'm bringing to the table. So that way I can confidently stand on any platform and say, you know, and call a spade a spade. One of my pet peeves is when, you know, anybody can go on Instagram and put up a hashtag,
yeah,
you know, hashtag George Floyd, hashtag, you know, police reform, hashtag defund police. But what are you going to do in 2 months from now when all this is over and you have the next big headline that's out? Like, what are you still actively doing? And so since I've been doing that work from day one, like, I still work a 40 hour a week job. Like, as soon as we get off today, I'm going to work and going to go on patrol, all while having a wife and 3 kids at home. And so I will stand on a platform and confidently say, what are you doing to actively change our society and our culture that we're living in? Because outside of, you know, being a social media influencer, what actual real work are you doing? And everything I just mentioned is the real work that I'm doing to try to change the narrative that we have today.
Bonjour, qu'est-ce que tu fais? Ah, bon, oui, oui. Oui, oui. Je t'aime l'école. Oui.
Oliver's French.
Now, see, I know French.
Oliver and I both learned French.
I actually took it in high school, didn't retain it much, and then I got back into my Babbel to learn French. Babbel is, it's an amazing app.
On Babbel, there's 14 languages you can choose from. Other than the fact that it would be fun to be completely, you know, at least understand and be able to communicate in a different tongue, it's also amazing for your brain. So Babbel can actually help you learn faster than you think. The thing is that every time I try to learn a different language, it's hard for it to stick. Like, it doesn't stay in your brain. And then when you try Babbel, you're going to get hooked, because what it does is it makes it fun. It makes it easy. And then you start having conversations, daily lessons, 10 to 15 minutes. They start by teaching you words and phrases en français, en espagnol, or whatever language you prefer. It, you know, you'll find yourself having, you know, actual conversations.
These lessons are thoughtfully created by over 100 language experts, and their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective across multiple studies. They even have speech recognition technology that helps improve your pronunciation and accent. That's what's cool about it too. Like, there are moments where you know your accent kind of sucks, and then they prompt you on how to say it correctly.
So it's proven to get you speaking the language within weeks, which is awesome. And as a matter of fact, I think I'm going to start. I've been doing French, and French comes easy to me because I have a real sort of foundation in French. But I think I'm going to say right now, I'm going to go on Babbel. I'm going to start Spanish. And I'm going to see where I get in the next month.
It's available as an app or online, so your progress will be synced across all devices. So right now, when you purchase a 3-month subscription, Babbel will give our listeners 3 additional months for free with promo code SIBLING. That's 3 additional months for free if you go to babbel.com and use the promo code SIBLING on your 3-month subscription. That's BABBEL.com, promo code SIBLING.
Sakara. Our favorite food delivery.
We're loyal to them. They're loyal to us. It's a beautiful, beautiful relationship.
Actually, it's funny. We've been in Colorado for a while. When I go home, I think I'm going to do a little Sakara. You know, I always do my WW because that keeps my points, right? And then food programs like Sakara, it's nice to be able to have food prepared, know that you're getting all great, healthy, plant-based ingredients.
you're sort of resetting. Whenever you need a reset, this is my number one.
It's not easy. It's hard to prepare healthy meals that also taste good. So that's why Sakara is the best.
Plant-based ingredients, all designed to boost energy, improve digestion. I say this every time. Get your skin glowing.
You know, my skin is glowing now, finally, for the first time in, let's see, I'm 43. I was 2 or 3 years old when my skin was good. Around 4, I started to get wrinkles. So I'd say about 39 years. It's been 39 years. My skin is finally glowing again, right? And right now, Sakara is offering our listeners 20% off their first order when they go to sakara.com/sibling or enter code sibling at checkout. That's Sakara, sakara.com/sibling to get 20% off your first order. Do it. Sakara.com/sibling. Do it.
I wonder, just to get both of your perspectives on this, when people are talking about, there's so much, I mean, clearly George Floyd, this horrific moment in history has changed history, I believe, that the conversation is at the forefront, will continue to be. And the fire that's sort of ignited right now is, I hope, this great opportunity where we will start to see people actually implementing it beyond the hashtag. But how far, where do we start? Meaning there's the police, but there's also, you know, the communities. We're learning about redlining right now. We're learning about systemic racism and things that I think so many people haven't been educated on. Money inside of the police force.
Yep.
How do we really talk about the allocation of funding when we are 20 to 30% budgeted towards the police force? And then so much of that budget could be actually going into, you know, whether it be inner city schools, whether it be healthcare system. Like, how do you tackle these questions when you're talking about such enormous issues?
So that's a great question. I always like to use examples. And I'm a former college athlete. I played college football at UNLV. And when I played college football, one of the things that I realized while I was there is, like, those football programs invest a lot of money into us as athletes. And why do they invest so much money into us as athletes? Is because they know on Saturday when we kick off, we better perform to our highest ability. So if you go on to YouTube right now and you can YouTube the University of Michigan's football facility, they just got a new facility and it's pretty cool. They have this thing called the car wash. And as soon as you leave the field, you take off your shoulder pads, you put them on the rack, they go clean them. And then you walk through this maze of showers that basically hits you from all angles. And then you go right into a cold pool and you walk through this little maze of a cold pool. And it's so that way that cold water just starts regenerating your body to heal faster. Well, I don't even want to imagine how much something like that costs, but I would imagine it probably costs
a lot,
a decent amount of money. But then they put that money into it is because they want the University of Michigan to win football games. So when we talk about this concept of defunding the police, on one hand, you have people saying police need more training, which you're absolutely right. If the officer that says, oh, we're trained enough, needs to exit the profession because you're stupid to think you've ever arrived. We can always do better. We can always train better. But on the other end of that, in order to train officers, you also need funding to train officers. So I just looked at our budget for the police department that I work at. And the two top things that our budget goes to is one, training, and two, police salaries. So you got to, let's dissect those two things. Police training. Why would you not want the best officers out there that are trained to the best of their ability to patrol your streets? Because at any given time, they can show up at your door. They're going to have to protect you or your family or somebody else. And I know for me and my family, I want to make sure that I have the best trained officer out there. On the flip side of that is you got to be competitive with the salaries for some police officers in certain places, because again, you want qualified candidates. So you lower the salary, you may also going to lower the quality candidates that you're going to get into that position. And so, you know, you say, hey, take all the money. Okay, well, where are the candidates going to come from now? Who's going to actually want to do this job that's qualified to do it? Because we talk about qualified candidates. And so, you know, if I could sum up this whole conversation and everything I've been doing to one word, it would be balance. Like right now in society, we're lacking balance. We have two extremes. You have the extreme is, hey, let's defund them, let's abolish them. You have the other extreme is, hey, police can do no wrong. There's no balance. Even in politics, we see it. You know, you're either Democrat or Republican. There's nowhere in the middle. And if you're in the middle, it's like, well, shame on you. So we lack balance. And it's the same thing when it comes to talking about funding the police. Is I'm all about reallocation of funds. But at the same time, we can't get this idea in our head to say, hey, look, let's take all the money away from them, because the police are a vital source to communities. With that, right now we're seeing in Atlanta, I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to the headlines, but after they prosecuted that officer, a lot of officers have stopped showing up to work. Mm-hmm. And so the mayor and some of the other city officials, they called for outside help to come help Atlanta, and they're and all the outside agencies say, hey, we're not coming, because officers are afraid to go to work. They're like, hey, if I do my job and something bad happens, well, now I know I'm not going to have any backing. And so they I think the last time I checked, they had about 1,000 calls holding. So imagine you being the person that calls the police because something is going on in your house, and dispatch tells you, hey, we're not coming to your house. We don't have any officers to show up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's crazy. I guess the question is, who wants to be a cop nowadays? You know what I mean?
No, I do.
Of course you do, because you're the man that way. But if you're coming in as someone who wants to, you know, protect and serve, mm-hmm. it's a scary proposition. I mean, what does it look like right now as far as even recruiting goes? I mean,
well, Bishop Omar said it best. Just like he was called to do the work, my job, it's a calling. You got to be called to do this. And so once you've identified that calling, now it's my job to help you get in the doors and help navigate you to be the best officer you can be for our communities. And so that's why I see it as opportunity. You and I talked about it earlier, Kate, as far as seeing this as opportunity, being optimistic about it. That's how I see it. And just, you know, I wrote an article for this. It was Police One and LexiPol, these two different sites. I wrote an article talking about why right now is the best time to become a police officer. So there was another officer that wrote an article that said, this is the worst time to become a police officer. And you, if you're in it, you should leave. And then all this other stuff. So I wrote a contrary article to that, basically saying, this is the best time because, you know, things are changing and we should be glad about that. So why not be a part of the change and figure out how we can redo things better as opposed to complaining about it? So, but again, it has to come with balance. Like in order for me to go mm-hmm. get some of the best qualified candidates, I got to be able to go out there and say, hey, look, man, like, I want you to go out there, put your life on the line. I want you to go out there and handle every call for service. I want you to go out there and deal with mental health. I want you to go out there and take people to jail. But at the same time, we're not going to compensate you.
Can I say something on this? I was thinking when you were just asking about the funding allocation, you know, it's like this. If you have right now, people don't buy albums, you know, they buy singles, you know, they just download the single, you know, we get to the album later. See, the single right now is police brutality. And so when you're talking about funds and how you do it, that's what I've been telling city officials and others, federal officials who I'm consulting or helping. I'm saying to them, because there is a lot. There's a lot we can say and a lot we can do when it comes down to justice and violence and fairness. But you got to go. And it was someone told me that. One of my mentors, Buster Sorey, said, Omar, you need to deal with the single. The single right now is police brutality. So let's figure out how to use the resources and the quality controls that we know and that we can help implement yep. to make that piece better. I don't mean everything. You know, we're gonna get to the album because the album is good. Because redlining, mm-hmm. that's part of the album.
Exactly.
But we won't deal with the single right now. You know, and that is that.
Exactly.
This is right. Bread out this. Go ahead.
But in order to deal with that single, in order to listen to that single and truly appreciate that single, do you have to hear that single in the context of the whole album? You know what I mean? Like when we're talking about police brutality, mm-hmm. we have to understand redlining. We have to understand, you know, even why the police mm-hmm. was even created in the first mm-hmm. place.
You're right in that. If you're trying to get an over, you know, we overstand. If you're trying to overstand the idea in its complexity, but see, if you've lived it, there's a difference in me being taught in theory about it and understand what the practical applications of it are. So depending on what lens you're coming from, I agree with you that those who want to become part of an activist community or really jump in, the more you know, the better equipped you are. But you shouldn't be paralyzed by I have to learn it all in order for me to be effective. See, you mean because it'll stop you, because this is a journey. I tell people all the time that peace is a process, it's not an event. When they ask me, you know, because I did a Crip and Blood peace treat, I said, that's not, you know, that wasn't the end, that was then all gang war is over. No. So the process continues because you are ever on this learning journey. So that's a beautiful thing when you start saying, wait a minute, this, see, and this is another thing too, Oliver, watch this. When I learn that 2 times 2 is 4, that don't mean I disrespect 2 plus 2. See, it just increases. You see what I'm talking about? It's just,
that's an OG statement.
OG statement. So you just, so it begins to build from where you are. And that's a beautiful thing. And it shouldn't cause you to be at all contained in a box. It's true stuff. See, that's why you really can't get to healing until you examine the sickness as thorough as you can. But at some point, you have to say, this requires a certain triage and a certain emergency application so that we can get to some deeper levels. But we do know that the deeper level, and like I said, now I have something called Urban Specialist. I've had Urban Specialists for the last 12 years. Urban Specialists, we train OGs, we do violence, we do a lot of stuff, and it's really powerful. And it, to me, is the key to unlocking these other doors in urban communities, especially as it relates to generational poverty and all kinds of other stuff. So I do it. I have a ministry that I believe in, Kingdom Worship. But again, at some point, I pull away from my understanding of what I'm doing and try to overstand where people are, because some people are passionate. Mm-hmm. And so you got to become, Henry Nouwen said, you got to become immersed in someone else's condition in order for you to actually give them quality care. So I become immersed in where they are and try to lead them through ways that they may not understand. Because if you're walking through a landfill, that field, you know, has landmines everywhere, and I know where the landmines are. My role is to say, I'm going to make sure you don't get blown up. And then I can teach you the strategy of how to figure it out. But the first goal is, let me get you out of this place so you won't destroy yourself.
Well, and on that point you bring up, son, Curtis, so I went to our city hall meeting last week. And at the city hall meeting, you had a lot of young adults there, you know, from, you know, 16 to 21, 22 years old. And they're there to basically boycott, because this meeting was to approve our police budget for the next year. And so they were all there boycotting, you know, passionate about, you know, defund the police. One girl even said, hey, you know, first we're going to defund the police, and then after we do that, we're going to talk about abolishing them. And so here's the unique thing about the whole thing, though, is that, you know, the people that were coming up to speak, they were, you know, some were white, some were Hispanic, some were Asian. And as I'm at this meeting, you know, some of them are saying, you know, the United States comes from deeply rooted history of, you know, slavery, and, you know, we got to, you know, it's evil stuff in the United States and all this other stuff, and Black Lives Matter and all this other stuff. But here's the whole irony of it. The irony of it was, there was only two Black people at the meeting, me and my lieutenant. So on one end, these people are there talking about, you know, we need to help the environment out, and, you know, Black Lives Matter and this, this, and that. But on the same exact can, they're basically talking about taking the food off of the way for me to provide for my own family off of the table, because now you want to not only take my job away, but abolish everything I have. And so one of the things that you said right now that was kind of critical, Bishop Omar, is the fact of, I'm somebody that's lived it. I've had ex-girlfriends that couldn't tell their family who they were dating because I was Black. I've had an ex-girlfriend whose dad said, you better not bring home any N-word babies. I've had, you know, I've walked in places and had been followed around because I look suspicious. So I've lived racial prejudiceness, you know, my entire life. And it was funny because for a while I forgot about a lot of it. It wasn't until the whole George Floyd thing that I start remembering all these experiences that I've had in my past. And I'm like, shoot, I forgot about all that. And so I've lived it. But at the same time, instead of getting caught up in where my past is and where my history is, I've been so preoccupied with the solution that I'm actually out there trying to be the solution in my day-to-day work. And so while everybody's at this board meeting talking about the history and where we come from and all that other stuff so they can understand it, I'm like, you guys should have been, if you guys were that passionate about it, you guys should have been doing this for years ago. And so I get it now, you know, on the, I like you said, Kate, I completely agree. The whole George Floyd thing is forever going to alter our history as a country for the positive. But at the same time, we need to become fixated with the solutions as opposed to just raising it. Like, I really believe that there are people out there right now that are trying to push their own agenda on the hill of Black agenda. You know what I mean? They're trying to use this race, this whole Black agenda, but they're trying to use their own, push their own agenda on the hills of that. And so I'm like, man, I'm so preoccupied with solutions, like going to Bishop Omar's thing on Wednesday. I'm like, man, let's get to it. Let's apply this as opposed to just talking about it.
Yeah, it's interesting because the pendulum seems to just be swinging all over the place though right now. You know, I mean, you have the extremes of abolish the police, and then it swings all the way over here. You know, I mean, at some point we got to find the middle ground. I think it's important though, because I do feel like that there has been a shift in consciousness overall. There's a global shift in consciousness. I guess the important thing though is, how do we keep this momentum? It's like what you said. Once all the protests are gone and everyone returns back to their lives, how does this movement sort of keep pushing forward? And I guess my question is, how integral are white people in pushing this thing through and actually, you know, making sure that we are seeing change?
You are asking the right questions, brother. The founding documents of America. There's a speech, Frederick Douglass, 1852, and the speech is, "What is the 4th of July to a slave?" It's a beautiful speech. Mm. It's a speech where he talks in rough terms. It's a rough speech. Like, I said this to some people the other day. I don't know who asked him to speak at that 4th of July celebration, but they got fired. You know what a booking manager was? He killing them, bro. Yeah, I'm talking about he killing them. He's saying, "What is 4th of July to a slave?" And he goes into this whole idea about you. He said, How disrespectful is it to take me into a place of freedom only to make sure that I see it but can't taste it? You know, he talks about a little girl who's 10-year-old who is walking in New Orleans and she's ripped from her mother. You know, he's just going through these, you know, he's like, so what is it? But then he says, but I don't come condemnatory. I come to say to you that the ideas that have been spoken of by your fathers and your brothers in that document called the Constitution, you must live up to them and purify it. Make this document live up to what it says it's supposed to be. That you don't, you don't. So how important are white people? I just got my hair cut because I was on this white podcast. Because we need you. It ain't no doubt about it. We need you right now. I mean, 10 toes in. Because you are right. There is a shift in consciousness right now, man. This is not what it was. So I know a lot of people say, no, it's not, man. This is a shift. And so we now have to say, now we need y'all to help us make sure that every idea that's spoken of lives up to its most pure moment, concentrated moment. Now, we may not get there, but we got to take this moment and shift it forward. So then we can at least say, well, we moved the needle somewhere. That's how you get that pendulum to slow down and get out of pace and the rhythm that we can go.
Yeah, and that's what I've been saying. That's what I say when I have conversations with my friends. And I also think it's extremely important for white people to all get together themselves and have these conversations.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of different opinions when it comes to
true.
It. You know, when you get into the depth of your friends and you really sort of dig down a little bit, you're like, oh, whoa, you don't see that the same way that I do. And let's have the discussion about it.
And I want to go back, Bishop, to what you were saying about the single right now, you know, police brutality. And that when people do, like Oliver was saying, pick a lane, but when you actually can focus in on one thing, you really can, you know, infiltrate, make a big difference. And if the single right now is police brutality, what's your sort of way in there? How are you going to sort of make that the hit single on the album?
Yeah.
You know,
well, the one thing is, before we identify the single, the one thing that's very, very important is we have to identify what police brutality is.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that's so important is because I think we've been led to believe that every video you see that's officers using force on somebody is police brutality when it's not. You know, think about the freedoms that we have, some of the freedoms we have in the country. Well, the freedoms that we have in the United States of America were not always accomplished by a pretty means. And so in law enforcement, there are situations I've shot my gun at somebody before. And for rightful reasons, and I'm not even going to get into the story of it, but it wasn't, I mean, anytime you see any act of violence, anything, it's not pretty. But when we don't get the full context of a video out there, we automatically assume, like, hey, that's police brutality. So I'm going to turn it back over to you, Bishop Over, but I think it's important to identify what police brutality is. And then once you identify what it is, then how do we work to resolve that police brutality?
That's a great point.
Very good, man. I think that, you know, we can be very specific. And thank you for that, Ron. You can be very specific. You know, George Floyd, you can be specific. Ahmaud Arbery, even though it was not police. Breonna Taylor, you can be specific now because we have some living examples that have deadly consequences. And here's the bottom line. The way we do this for police brutality in particular is three things. One, we have to encourage a community style policing avenue that will look different because it's 17 or 18,000 different police operations, you know, locally. So it's not like one policing. It's police agents, all different. So there has to be tailor-made in a localized sense. But, and like you said, this is a marathon, but that's one thing. So you have to open that portal back up, which will make us vulnerable. That's going to make folks vulnerable because that means you're going to have to know Ryan. Look, when I did this, and I don't like to tell all these stories, but I'm just going. So when we did this with the Crips and Bloods, right, I had all of the leaders of the Crips and Bloods sit down with the sergeants and the beat staff of the police. At this gymnasium, and it was a real conversation, and it was raw, and it was not made for TV, but it was good because we're gonna get this out because I'm telling the police I need these guys for peace, and some of the police were saying, well, these are the guys we warned against, and we got to a mutual understanding where it was not really us against it was a few, but for the most part everyone was trying to do right. So what I'm saying is that kind of community aspect of policing, so it's not as militarized. That's one. Something else about the policing idea is we cannot, as Ryan was talking about, we have to de-stress the police environment to where the police has to be a catch-all for everything that's in our community is problem. You can't do that. It's irrational for them to be counselors and undertakers and you know, everything that they have to be just so that they can perform the duty. So we have to restructure what that looks like. Have to do some training. But here's the main thing. This is like COVID, Corona. There's not a cure, but there is a commitment to be all in on the call. Not a cure, but we are committed to be all in on the cause. So that then flattens the curve. So that means people practice social distancing, folks wash your hands, da, da, da. So me and Ryan, we like Dr. Fauci. You know, we're telling you that there is a way to get through this. Now, if we don't, some of us may die. But if we do this right, we can get through it. And at some point, we will blunt the idea of a racialized environment being a normative and for brutality to be the first order of defense. And so you got to treat it like that. And that becomes on your individual stuff. Like, and I can give you some examples of what that looks like with us and with, you know, all kinds of ways. But the point in, that's the kind of mentality that has to take over this narrative. And then the actions will start following as a natural course. And then we'll start seeing changes that's not systemic, like one person. Like in the Black community, you hear this all the time. See, man, the white folks. And I was like, do y'all know where these white folks is? Because I can go, we can stop the whole deal. If you just show me where the 15 white people that y'all are talking about, we can...
You're so right, Bishop Omar. And you know, and I was going to say the last point I'm going to make on that is, you know, we have to, one of the things I've been criticized from doing from day one is we as officers have to be able to call out the ones that are doing police brutality. So I've called out officers, you know, hey, man, this was not proper policing. And it shouldn't have been done this way. And like the moment George Floyd happened, I called it out right away. But that wasn't new for me. I don't know one police officer that tried to stand by and justify that guy's action. Mm-hmm. Not one. So that right there is proof that we are moving in the right direction. But what was new for everybody else was not new for me. And I've already been criticized for it because I've actually come out publicly and I do videos on my Instagram. They're called Tillman Takes, where I break down police videos and I'll say either it was right or it was wrong. And that's another way in order to continue to move that pendulum forward is by having officers willing to come out and identify wrong when wrong is being done.
Yeah.
And you haven't always seen that systematically in our profession.
What we're talking about is we're talking about what you would say in a workplace is your workplace environment. You know, when, you know, as a business, you know, when you're looking at your business and everything you wanted, your work culture, what does that feel like? What does that look like? And one of the questions, I don't know this information. I'm just asking if you do, Ryan, is have you looked into the allocation of salaries? Have you looked at who gets paid what?
Yeah. So kind of going back to Bishop Omar's point is policing across the United States is vastly different, mm-hmm. vastly. Like that's a problem, you know, because if I do policing one way here in California, but it's done completely opposite in New York, mm-hmm. we're still painted with the same broad brush and people are now attributing my mistakes as the same in the guys in New York, but it's vastly different. I will tell you that California, we're light years ahead of a lot of the majority of the country when it comes to policing in many ways. In fact, you'll talk to officers across the country and they're like, man, if you're a California cop, we look at you guys as being tacticians because we train a lot more from a tactical standpoint as other departments. But there are departments right now that you can go to and there's guys walking around, they're 18 years old with a badge and a gun on their chest mm-hmm. that haven't even gone to an academy yet because they don't even have the ability to send anybody to the academy yet because of funding and all this other stuff.
Right.
But yet they still have a need. And so, but you come to California, you're not going to see that. So the reason I say that is because every department is so different. You know, you'll have some departments where it's super top heavy, where all the commanding officers make all this money, but the low line guys aren't really making that much. You'll go to another department where it's pretty balanced. And so that's why I say if we talk about reforming the police or reformation of the police, we got to, I believe we should have more of a systematic approach that's, you know, federally,
right,
that says, hey, look, this is the standard that every officer should be at. You know what I mean? And that, you know, if you're an officer that doesn't like that, well, then you don't need to be in it because we're talking about raising standards, which is good. And if you raise standards, now if a situation happens in Timbuktu, Idaho, I know that that officer was trained very similar to me. And now we can all say, yep, that was wrong, as opposed to, well, what's this officer's level of training? Mm-hmm. Is it the same that we have here in California? Is it vice versa?
Ryan, you could also look at it as voting, too, mm-hmm. in terms of being very involved locally in how you vote.
Without a doubt, it's very important to go down to your cities and find out who your mayor is, your city council members and all that other stuff, because that was created so that you would have a voice. And me and Bishop Omar knows this, too, is like that's why a lot of our ancestors like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, that's why they fought so we can get voting rights. So why would they fight for us to get voting rights in some aspects? But yet we don't utilize the rights that they fought for. So, you know, there's a lot of
tactics vary from department yes. to department across the United States, meaning like one department might see this as police brutality and another one just doesn't.
Without a doubt. So I can tell you in California, you have the California Post, which is a police officer standardized training. Everybody in California, if you want to be an officer in California, you have to go through the Post standardized training. So in a level in California, we're already kind of doing that standardized training. But you go to department, you're from some departments, like my department, we're huge in training. That's all we do. And so you might go to the neighboring department where they might not train as much as us. And so you go across the United States, it's going to be vastly different. That's why, like, anytime I go outside of, I always look at it like this, is like when I travel outside of the country as a police officer, they find out I'm a police officer in Southern California, they look at me as playing Division I ball as opposed to playing Division III ball. Because they're like, oh, we know how you guys train tacticians. You guys, I mean, SWAT developed out of LAPD. So they're like, oh, man, you guys are differently on your
tactics. Let me ask you a question, Ryan. When you're looking at statistics then of California versus other parts of the country, is the track record better for California because there is better training? Does that actually reflect in the numbers?
So without looking at the numbers, and I haven't, so I'm not going to sit here and act like I've looked at the mm-hmm. numbers, but I can tell you, though, you don't see as many incidents that we see that are publicized that come from California as opposed to other places. Now, we've had our fair share. Don't get me wrong, because it's still, we're human beings and we have officers that shouldn't be officers. We had recently, there was LAPD breakdown that I did where the LAPD officer beat somebody up that he shouldn't have beat up, and I called it out. So you still, that's a human problem that we're trying to fix. But as far as when it comes to tactics, yeah, it's vastly different. I looked at the situation in Atlanta, and from a tactical standpoint, I was like, the tactics were off in that. They should have, I mean, if this guy is, you know, supposedly driving drunk or you believe he's under the influence of alcohol, the first thing you don't want to do is let him get back in that car to go park it. You know what I mean? What you need to do is walk him to the side and somebody else go drive it, because the last thing you want to do is put an intoxicated driver back in the car. Mm. But that's something we teach and we train. That I can't say that's the same out there. You know what I mean? There's guys that do DUI investigations to put the guy in the front seat of their police car and do the investigation. That's terrible tactics. But again, other people train differently.
We've known for a long time that there's been so much corruption inside of police, the police institution. Mm-hmm. And I think now more than ever, people are sort of, it's like a call to action. But then you look at someone like Breonna Taylor and you're talking about the differences of, you know, state. And I, again, I don't know this information. Maybe you can help me with this. But like, how are those guys walking right now? Is that because of their unit? Is that how are these guys not held responsible?
Mm-hmm. You know, let me say something, hey, because you're hitting on something. Now, and I love Ryan. Yeah, I think y'all know that. I'm a fan of my brother. But let me just tell you, just talking about L.A., you know, the reason L.A. has a robust training is because, see, we remember Rodney King.
Yep.
We remember that. That was in L.A. The reason people are so appalled is because it was these other officers who watched this man kill.
Yep.
This brother, they watched him kill him. Mm-hmm. We feel like that because Ahmaud Arbery, for months, the police officers felt like it was no need in bringing up any charges and stuff like this. So this kind of idea, this corruption idea, is real. That's mm-hmm. that's not.
Oh, without then, a doubt.
And like without you said, and let me say something about Breonna Taylor and Antiana. Jefferson, that happened in Dallas. And other people, you know, when they are sitting down playing video games and the police officer kills them or eating ice cream, you know, now here's mm-hmm. here's the problem. Now let me get to the for me, Kate, what that means. That is a marginalization of Black lives that has been brought to bear in our systems, whether intentionally, unintentionally, whether what, because there is no way any plausible human would say that Ahmaud Arbery, who was ran down and shot and killed, mm-hmm. someone would not have said he got to go, these guys got to at least get tried. When you have someone like, and this is not a police officer, but I'm talking about the idea, when you got somebody like George Zimmerman signing Skittles packages about Trayvon Martin, you know, So our brains, and then just like Ryan, when I was working for the prison, I'll never forget, I was driving home and my 2 and 3 year old babies were in the car and I had some tickets. I hadn't paid a ticket. Police officer stopped me and this guy and my 2 and 3 year old are screaming in the back and I'm telling, calm down. I got some tickets I got to pay. And this guy, he has a cigarette. He blows a cigarette in my face and he says, you going to jail tonight. And those babies back there, they going to Child Protective Services. And my kids screaming because they don't understand. They just see me getting out the car. And I got out of the car, and the guy handcuffed me. And the way my kids were screaming, I remember, this is me. This is someone who understands the system. I said to that police officer, I'm going to kill you, man. My mind left. And he started laughing. He said, how you going to do that? Because I was handcuffed. And then when he pulled out my badge, he saw that I worked for the prison. He said, why didn't you tell me you was one of us, man? And blah, blah, blah. And then he put me back in the car. And I never forget driving home. And my mind had to say that was him and that was not a them. But if you see too many of him, you start saying that's them. And when you start believing that that's them, we have this, the only way that the them can get away with it is they have police immunity. They have, you know, certain unions that kind of sweep it up. You got your code of silence. There's not that many Ryan Tillmans. I know he believes it is, but it's not.
No, I know
it's not that many brothers who are gonna be bold enough to say, brother, it's corrupt. So that's why it's important that protesters and whites and blacks and clergy and this keep the pressure on so that these systems can't hide under this veil. Because this is a veil, man, and this is a veil that we all know. Mm-hmm. And listen to this last statement, that you don't have to have been a partaker of the problem to be a partaker in the solution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You qualify. You qualify because you care.
Yep, mm-hmm. exactly.
You qualify to mm-hmm. ask the question, man. So let me get off of that.
But it leads me to a question, actually. Ryan, like, how real is that code of silence in these departments?
I can only speak to my experience with my department. And, you know, I can't speak to anybody else. At my department, another thing. So you look at the bigger agencies like your LAPDs, you look at the Rampart scandals and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. That stuff is real. Even LA County sheriffs had a underground ring of violence that they were, you know, making inmates fight each other. That stuff is real. But you look at an apartment like mine, where is from top down, that's not the expectation is, no, we're going to lead with community policing first. We're going to, like, one of our mottos is you're going to lead the citizen with WOW service. So you don't, we don't necessarily experience, I've never experienced that code of silence unless people just don't talk around me. But at the same time, I know what the expectations of the person in charge are from the chief on down. And if you do have somebody that's not going along with that vote, they're not going to work at our police department. I've seen that. And so that's where I see the level of hope is that if my police department can operate, you know, full steam and know that, you know, have that, hey, we're going to put the customer first. We're going to deliver that WOW service. I know other police departments can do it, but like Bishop Omar said, I also know the reality is not every police officer is like me. Just yesterday, and everything that we talk about, I was training somebody yesterday, and just yesterday we pulled somebody over whose lady was in the front seat. She was pregnant, and almost, you know, she said the baby's due in a couple weeks. They had a child in the back seat, and the guy didn't have a driver's license. You have a lot of officers that wouldn't care, no empathy at all. Pulled him out, probably, you know, give him a ticket, towed the car, handcuffed him, whatever it may be. I said, hey, look, ma'am, are you about to have this baby right now? She said, no. Do you have a valid driver's license? Yes, I do. This is what we're going to do. I want you to hop in the driver's seat, and my man, you're going to hop in the passenger seat, but I'm letting you know now you need to go get that driver's license taken care of. Go ahead and do it so that way you can legally drive your lady to and from where she needs to go. So then I go back and show my trainee, and I'm like, look, everything I talk about on my podcast, everything I show, you're actually getting to see I lead the same exact way in the field. And so by infiltrating the system from within, not only are we talking about recruiting, but we're also talking about training now. So you start getting these good qualified candidates now training their trainees to do the exact same thing. That's how you start this systematic change from within, by acknowledging, hey, look, you know, you got to lead with the empathy, you got to lead with the respect, got to lead with the love, but this is how you actually do it. This is how you apply it. So I know that there are police officers that don't care and that would tow the car and that would do this. And so my job is to expose some of those guys too. Let me speak to the other side now, because I talked about the bad officers. But again, remember, I always talk about balance. And what I think what makes me different is I can see the lens from both sides. So part of my job, I'm going to give you guys an example. A couple years ago, I went on a dying or drowning two-year-old boy call. One of the worst things ever. Kid gets out. He gets in a pool. And nobody knows. And he basically, we have to give him CPR and all to find out that he passes away. Go handle that call. And now I got to go respond to the lady who's calling because her next door neighbor's dog is barking too loud. Or now I pull somebody over who is driving without a license, not even realizing that, hey, I just came and just dealt with this trauma. And so we talk about resources. We talk about defunding and reallocation. You got to understand is like when you get pulled over by that officer, in your mind, you're just thinking like, hey, why are you treating me like a freaking complete a-hole? But not even realizing like, okay, well, what actually ended up happening? Like, I've gone on calls, I kid you not, where a guy ran from me because he didn't want to go back to jail and literally took his life right in front of me, ran in front of a car, got hit up 10 feet in the air, and then ran over by another car, and he was dead on impact. I've gone on a call where you got a five-year-old kid that was outside playing, got hit by a car, and now I'm out there seeing him tossing and turning and stuff like that, and, you know, with foam coming out of his mouth because he's about to take his last breath. So those same officers are the same officers that are out there that are supposed to go and handle the counseling calls, that are supposed to go arrest the people, take them to jail. And so what I'm saying is not an excuse. So I don't want people to think
we actually have one of Oliver's best friends is a sheriff. We talk about this. He talks about that a lot, you know?
Yeah. So the hard part is the challenge is, okay, how do we find the officer that the intentions that are hard are just in a bad place and they don't need to be an officer, as opposed to the officer that's going through some trauma who needs to be off the street because he's not going to be able to best serve you when he pulls you over.
Right.
And that's where a lot of departments, like my department, is on the forefront of that. We have this thing called the peer counseling team. We have, you know, anytime we have a traumatic event, whether you like it or not, you're coming back to the department, you're not going back into the field, and they're going to be sit down and talk to you, whether you want to say it or not. but not every single department is doing that. And that's what I'm saying. So police reform is good. I personally believe our police department is on the forefront of doing a lot of these things. We talk about mental health calls. Mental health is one of the biggest things blowing up right now. But at the same time, you got officers out there that are ill-equipped to handle mental health calls. So what our department did is we actually brought somebody from the Department of Behavioral Unit, and they're staged at our police department, and we work in partnership with each other on trying to help people, give them better resources.
So then let me ask you a quick question then. Does it seem counterintuitive then to sort of defund the police when we're actually, this is actually, it's more about, you know, what if we said, well, no, increase the funding of police because we need better training, more training, you know, let's take the militarized aspect of the police, meaning we don't need 7,000 tanks, mm-hmm. and we don't need our police looking like they're like about to go to war, you know, mm-hmm. as far as just an aesthetic, as far as the optics go, but we actually need more funding so we can have better training.
So I've been saying that from day one. And again, a lot of agencies out here on Southern California have already done that. You know what I mean? But at the same time, we can't say everybody else is, but we all get the bad rap on. And so there it's a whole, like Bishop Omar said earlier, like we got to identify certain problems right now. The problem is police brutality. But when you start to unpeel that layer and that onion, you start to see all these deeper, really issues and the education. I tell people one of the top, you know, I talked about that five list. One of the things was go down to your local police department, get involved in citizens academies, go on ride alongs, learn about these people, learn about the job. You know, I wear one of those militarized uniforms. But if you learn about why I wear it, it's because the statistic and the science and the medical staff has shown is that when you wear that vest, it's called an outer vest. It actually removes the pressure, takes a lot of the pressure off of your hips where your gun belt is at. And that way it can give you a lot more endurance throughout your career as opposed to your back going out, because one of the leading causes of earlier police retirements is people's back going out. So you wear it because now it redistributes that weight on your body. So it looks militarized, but at the same time, that's why we wear it. And so if you know that, it's like, okay, that kind of makes a little bit of a sense. So there's so much that goes into it, whether it be education, you know, recognizing the wrong. I recognize the wrong. I know we can do better. But, you know, we got to be able to have these conversations.
As a police officer, though, where do you stand on the defund the police? And by the way, I think words matter and it's semantics. This idea that defund the police, I wish there was honestly a better way to say
it. It should be called reallocate.
Exactly like what that. I said is the reallocation, the defund. Yeah. The connotation is so bad.
No. We need provocative words to get people to listen, and sometimes.
Yeah, but
Bishop Omar.
No,
why
know,
are you laughing?
I think
it's provocative.
Yeah,
and it gets people to listen. And I think saying defund the police has made more people look at really even just how the police are funded. I mean,
yeah, but
so,
most people think the that they're like,
then
oh,
you can soften
defund
the language.
I had to look it up. I mean, I had to look it up.
And that's the sad part is like I tell people, with influence comes responsibility. And a lot of people don't take that responsibility serious. So when we put stuff out there like that,
you gotta explain.
Most people are not going to go beyond Instagram and find out what defund the police
exactly.
means.
Which is why you know what I mean? Which is why you put it out there and you tell them what it means.
It is so funny. I'm laughing, man, because this is really a brother and sister argument, and I'm just loving it, man. I'm just letting y'all go right in, man. And Ryan, you her brother's friend. And y'all going at it, man. I'm just saying,
like, I am very interested. I'm about education right now. I say 70% of people who are hashtagging defund the police don't really understand what that means. And they're thinking, oh, abolish the police. I mean, I just feel like as far as rhetoric goes, there's a better way to sort of say it. Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that what you do, let me show you something. I did a gang intervention one time with the Aryan Nation, right? These all Aryan Nazis. And I was sitting in there and they said, we hate black folks and we hate, you know, he was just going. They was like, no, we don't hate you, sir. This is just what we're saying. I said, ain't no problem, man. Y'all go right ahead. What I realized was that some people have to get all of that out so they can get to the truth. So you need some people to say some stuff that's wild, but they normally settle in on some true stuff, you know, because end of the day, I was like, do y'all want to get out of prison? Do y'all want to stay? Because I can, you know, I can kill. We can stop the meeting. Y'all just go ahead and try to figure out which one of these Latin Kings you're going to get killed by in this prison. But that's back in the day. The point I'm making is that sometimes the rhetoric is provocative because it creates that kind of energy. But you cannot excuse the form for function. The functionality is where we want to get to. So even if the rhetoric is a little explosive, we have to be the ones that say, I get it. You know, I tell people, because, you know, some folks say, man, these Black Lives Matter people need to stop. And they go, I said, hold on, man. When someone loses a child, I don't have the right to say, hey, don't cry that loud. You know, you guys kind of loud. You kind of get on spirit. You know, you can't. So you're going to have some explosive stuff like defund. I mean, that's okay. We shouldn't even be offended by it. I understand what you're saying, Ryan, that people got to have a certain amount of responsibility, but I'm not offended by that. I'm not offended when they're saying, let's tear it all down. Now,
no.
I'll be offended if that's where we stay, but it doesn't matter if that's where we start, because we can move from that and say, that's not logical and that don't make sense. So let's get to some places where it makes sense at. But I understand people who have to get that out.
You know, Bishop, my therapist always says, in a relationship, you gotta only let one person go crazy in a moment, and you gotta let him go, and then you gotta try to understand.
True. And, I mean, I don't know who your therapist is, but they are right. You do, man, someone has to be the grown up.
And that's what I do, and that's what I'm doing for you guys is like telling the police officers, like, look, like let them do what they have to do. Like, it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean. Look, man, you can't. This is an unprecedented time. I mean, no matter how sane and righteous and all of that, you can't look at George Floyd lose his life like that, man, and be the same. Man, you can't be the same. So you have to let all of that happen. And there's going to be some opportunists that we got to deal with. There's going to be some folks who don't have enough credibility that we have to deal with. But that's okay. It's worth it to get this right. Mm-hmm. To get how we're gonna be in our future of policing, it's worth it. It's worth all of the misunderstanding, it's worth all of that, because it's too much at stake. This is a fabric of our whole humanity is at stake. It's how you treat justice. Justice is too important to play with. Because when you lose justice and you lose that ability to see folks beyond where they are and can be aspirational, you lose a part of your humanity that if you lose it, it's hard to get back. Because I've seen people when that light is at their eye, and it's very dangerous when we start saying it's a for real dog-eat-dog world, and see, I'm just however you go, it go like that. That can harm you. That can put you in a box that it's hard to get out of.
Ryan, have you experienced racism within your department, meaning internally?
Well, I would say, I mean, you have implicit and explicit biases. I wouldn't call it racism. I would call it like their ignorance or lack of being able to just relate to other people. You know what I mean? Because of their upbringing. Like, for example, like I've never seen anybody blatant. And again, you're not going to, I'd be crazy if I saw somebody just call me an N-word or this was flat out racist to me. But what I do see is that people don't know how to, you know, relate to other people that grow up differently from them in inner cities, you know, and it's more of an ignorance, and it's more of also implicit and explicit biases that we talk about, which is for another conversation. Talk about the systematic racism. I mean, you got to go back to blackface days and all that, when, you know, making people black people or dressing up as black people and making them look like scary and stuff like that. But a lot of that stuff has been ingrained through the music we listen to, through the movies we watch, the way we all perpetuate ourselves. That's why when I tell young black kids, I'm like, man, stop calling each other the N-word. Stop. Like, I used to use it all the time. But stop doing that, because now we're perpetuating a stereotype, and we're also doing something that goes in opposition to what our ancestors fought against. So, again, I have that ability to relate to them. So to answer the question, have I seen blatant racism in my department? No. But do I see that there's officers that can't relate to other people that are from other cultures? Yeah, I see that for sure.
So, Bishop, what if the first single is police brutality? What are we coming with for the second single?
it's gonna be getting brothers and sisters to get along on podcast. That's the EP. That's my second single. How can brothers and sisters connect? No, man, I'm gonna tell y'all, man. The second thing I think is citizenship. I think that's where the next layer of this flows up to. What does citizenship look like in its best form? Because right now, I think that's where we are in America, is that there's a citizenship issue that says there is a group of citizens in America who have been conditionally marginalized, and it is taking the life out of this system we call this charged environment right now that's in the culture, both politically and societally, and it's bad. So we would have to raise from saying this is the highlight to now let's see what that citizenship. So that means schools, that means health, that means finance, that means opportunity, that means, you know, citizenship is the next thing. And so you have to then walk out where you are needed in your citizenry. So that truly means you're gonna have to have some personal conversations with people that you love, like you said, your friends. And you're gonna have to have some personal interactions with folks that you may not understand. So we can say, how do we as citizens get along in this new America that's coming up? Because it won't be like it was.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's easier to repair. It's easier to. I'm butchering this so bad right now, but it's easier to help children than to repair broken men or something like that. And that's where I think a lot of my time is spent, with educating the kids and pouring into the kids. I'm gonna send you guys, I don't know, I'll get your contact information, but I'm gonna send you an email that I got that was so cool from a kid's mom actually. Mm-hmm. And Bishop Omar, you're gonna love this one actually. But he comes from a gang family, and I went and did one of my presentations at a school. And last week she sent me an email just saying how she saw, I guess, because there I had a news story that aired last week, and she didn't know how to get a hold of me, but she found out how to get a hold of me for that news story. And she wanted to thank me because her son, you know, who comes from a deeply enriched gang family, now wants to be a police officer and be a part of the change as opposed to part of the problem. And so now this is a black kid, mom is taking her down to the police station to become an explorer, to get involved in the Citizens Academy, all that stuff. And so that right there was that's why I do it. And that's the proof right there is like, I don't need everybody to become a police officer. All I want to do is to be able to have real open, honest conversations and just talk about the human beings behind, you know, not just put the badge, but just human beings in general. I mean, that's why the four of us can have a conversation like this and not get in our feelings. I remember going to marriage counseling before we got married, and, you know, being our counselor saying is, hey, look, you got to be able to agree to disagree on things. What's the intent? Like me and my wife, we've gotten a couple arguments, but we'll ask each other. Sometimes I'll ask is like, when I did whatever I did that made you mad, was my intent to make you mad?
Right.
Or was my intent to really do good, but I just screwed up because I'm a screw up. Mm-hmm. And so when you really look at that, you start looking behind a person's intent, it really kind of starts to soften your heart and say, look, they weren't trying to do that. And I tell that to the officers, like, look, why is this person strung out on drugs? You know, because it's so easy to write them off and be like, oh, this is just a tweaker, this is that. Like, well, why? And so when you start figuring out the why aspect, it softens your heart and you start to realize the intent of a person's actions, and it makes you lead a lot differently. And that's why I think I lead a lot differently as an officer, because I'm like, look, I always tell people, I'm not here to judge you. Like, we all got a maker that's going to judge us one day. It don't mean I'm going to stop you from taking a jail, but at the same time, I at least want to get to know you as a human being, because that's my job and obligation to you as a public servant, one, and two, as a follower of Jesus Christ.
Well, yeah. Ryan, you know, as a mother of three kids, I always say you lead by example. You know, it's a cliche, but sometimes when things start to feel overcomplicated and you wish you could do so much, it's sometimes nice to remember that even if we're just leading by example, even if we just affect one person, it matters. True. And you're clearly leading by example. So
yeah, Kate, you're totally right.
Real quick, I just want to say that the quote is, it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men.
Whoa, right. That's why you're my sister.
No, but I was going to say, Kate, I totally agree with that, because, you know, you affect one life, you know, you create opportunity for one person. You know, there's an exponential sort of component to that, because you can change the sort of legacy and the history of an entire generation with just affecting one person, because then that spiders out.
Right. Well, it's also, if your intention is for the betterment of humankind, you're going to be walking the right path. I think the things that end up mattering and that end up actually changing is when we can all, like what we're doing right now, hopefully people are going to listen to this. But the reality is we all just affected each other. And that will inspire us to reach out and continue to do the good work.
That's pretty presumptuous. I mean, I don't know if the bishop is going to, I don't know if Orion's going to leave this podcast and be like, Oliver Hudson really affected me.
I'm just a little upset that Oliver didn't say I look like John Legend, but
you
it's all
do
good.
Look like John Legend.
You know what, man? You know, we say, Kate, we say one of the things that we tell people is only inspired people can inspire people. That's one of the phrases that we say, so you're right. And you have to choose an inspiration and live so fiercely in the moment that you're looking for that inspiration. That's, you know, goes way back to the first question. How did I know Ryan was that type? Because I'm always living looking for it, because it's important to have it. And it is an energy refiller. It kind of refills your own source and your own strength. And then I pray a lot. You know, I'm always praying and I'm asking God, what all of my steps, let make sure I can hear, because I want to hear it in the way they're trying to say it, not in the way I want to get it. I want to understand and really, like you said, I'll have compassion. So these things are important. And it sounds simple, but it's an active learning and an active, you know, game in your mind. But it really frees you. It'll free you up and you'll be surprised. And then you'll say, man, I made a couple of steps, but it was a guy, Wilson Good. He was the mayor of Philadelphia. And I was with him in his program. He did called Amachi. Who knows what God is going to do through this child? It's a Swahili word. Who knows what's going to happen from this one child? So you know, you just assume that we go all in all the time. And then, you know, these kinds of platforms, they help. This kind of dialogue, it helps. And you guys help. Believe that. This is important in the path of how we can figure this out, because it's real. This is real, man. You know, this is no joke. This is real. But we can be inspiring as we deal with real things.
Before we go, I just want to ask what you guys are going to be doing in Dallas. Can you share what this big event is that you're doing?
Thank you. It's called Heal America. We're bringing so many cultural influences, business influences, OGs, regular folks. Just we're all coming together to have a conversation about how do we purify these ideas of citizenship and deal with race and humanity. So we're going to be, you know, really talking about those things from different lenses, but all on the same page that we got to get better. And then we'll shift into some solutions. So it's going to be an inspirational deal too. But it will have practical outcomes, like the police reform stuff we'll come out with and some more practical solutions. But we're going to really have an in-depth look at it, and it will inspire your folks. They will leave saying, okay, this is tough, but we can do this. So they can just go to Heal America Tour. HealAmericaTour.com.
HealAmericaTour.com.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Ryan, I have a quick question, man, or just to end, just about law enforcement in general. Obviously, we know you believe in law enforcement. Why should we have faith in law enforcement? And what does law enforcement need to do to be better? Why should we believe in it at this point?
Why should you believe in it is because that email or the story I just shared you with you right now is somebody that at a young age, at 15 years old, is already affected and saying he wants to be a part of the change. I can go off email after email after email. My chief of police actually called me in his office and he told me, he said, Ryan, he's like, you know what's funny is over the last year and a half, almost every single application that we get at this department is somebody saying that, hey, the only reason I want to come work at your department or this department is because I follow Ryan on Instagram and I value everything that he stands by and what his mission is to do. So that's just one place. So you imagine if I can just change mindsets by having platforms and different things like that, that those are all the incoming people. So as we get rid of the old people and we start getting this new generation and these new way of thinking, this new mindset, that's the hope. And the other part of that is we need policing. Like we need, like when my wife stays at home with our three children. And the last thing I would want is for somebody to come to our house and victimize my wife and kids and nobody be able to protect her. And so we got it. Like I said, going back to that word balance, we got to find out what that balancing act is. And what we're doing right now, this is that balance. This is that ability to be able to have an educated dialogue with one another, be able to either agree on everything or agree to disagree on some topics, but also be able to go out there and put the work in with each other. You know what I mean? So I don't see two extremes here. I see everybody else being able to come together as human beings and be able to just have good dialogue with each other and be able to go out there and do it. You know, Bishop Omar is handling on the on the spiritual end and with his congregation and his community. You guys got to put your hope in knowing that there's guys like me that are inside the profession that have the same aspirations as you guys. And then you know, you and Kate Oliver, you guys are doing some phenomenal work just by utilizing your voice, by having me and Bishop Omar on your guys' platform in order to share this. I mean, I can't thank you guys enough. You know, that just lends your guys' heart and two, your ability to realize and recognize that you guys have something that can, you know, ultimately be out for the better cause. So I'm excited. You know, I feel like this is a good friend. By the way, my wife wanted me to let you know she loves your leggings.
Yeah, great.
Well, you guys, this has been really amazing.
Been so great.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much. Talk to you guys soon.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Sibling Revelry is executive produced by Kate Hudson, Oliver Hudson, and Sim Sarna.
Supervising producer is Allison Bresnik.
Editor is Josh Windisch.
Music by Mark Hudson, a.k.a. Uncle Mark.